We are joined this morning by Matthew Nelson. He's one half of Nelson. The other one is Gunner. Now, Matt, is Gun his name? Is that what you guys refer to him? Gun? Is that usually?
Well, I call him Bro G-Man. I call him a lot of things. I just don't call him Matt. I reserve that for me. But, yeah, usually the gunman is
right.
What I call him.
Right. Well, you seem to be the more talkative of the two. Would that be correct if I was to say that? Or?
It depends on the mood of the day, I think. I don't know. I think maybe a little bit. Gunnar and I, of course, we're identical twins. And we have, we're called mirror twins. I'm a righty. He's a lefty. We kind of split, like, almost like book matched. And we have different personalities that I think augment each other. I tend to be a bit more affable. Gunner tends to be a little more acerbic, but not in a bad way. He's got a wonderful heart. He just, Gunner doesn't think about things before he says them. He has no filter. I kind of like am the, you know, I'm the diplomat. So that's pretty much the differences.
That's why they probably have you be the spokesperson, so that you make sure you say all the right things. Let's talk about what's coming up on the 19th over here at the Hoke Theater of the Stocker Arts Center of Lorain County Community College. You're bringing the Ricky Nelson Remembers tour, you and your brother performing songs of your father's. Tell me a little bit about how that sort of came to be, if you would.
Well, it's an awfully long story. Gunner and I sold a few million records to people who had no idea who our dad, Ricky Nelson, or Ozzy and Harriet, our grandparents, were. And we had gotten to a point where, you know, we'd made our own mark and had our own number one records that we wrote and toured the world. And no matter where we went, we ran into people that were affected by our dad's music and his influence, or grew up with the Ozzy and Harriet show, which ran, 435 episodes in 14 years on American TV. And they would always ask us to play his tunes. And we'd throw in Garden Party or Hello Mary Lou or Traveling Man. And the fact is, Gunner and I were, our dad was our best friend, and we missed him immensely, still do. You know, I always say that the pain becomes an ache, the hurt becomes an ache and stuff, but it doesn't go away. And we found that when somebody in the military asked us to do a theme concert and play all Ricky Nelson songs over in Japan for the sailors over in Yokosuka Naval Base, our argument was people that young probably don't know who we are, let alone our father. And when we started playing it, of course we went and we did it, we realized that, first of all, the music was amazing. These 18, 19-year-old kids were out there dancing, having a great time. And Gunner and I had this amazing wealth of material to put into a show, which was 435 episodes of the Ozzy and Harriet show, 40 years of interview footage. I mean, our dad was probably arguably the most televised rock star in history. And so we combined this great music, which is, 40 Billboard Top 40 hits and a bunch of number ones. I mean, honestly, the show is nothing but hit songs from start to finish. And all this wonderful video that tells this great story. And then, of course, we get to impart our own stories of our dad. And what people get is a whole lot more than somebody just playing some songs they remember or, hey, yeah, this was a famous guy. It's a connection of the Nelson family with, I think, the American consciousness over the last 50 years. And I think we kind of, honestly, it's very relevant now with what's going on in America. And, I'm very proud to bring the show to you guys.
Growing up in this family, at what point do you remember thinking, hey, I'm part of a famous family?
Honestly, I didn't really realize it at all. I honestly thought that it was, I joke and say in the show, I thought it was normal for people to ask your entire family for autographs at dinner when you went out. I didn't know. I thought it was just a normal thing. I believe I was about 4 years old, and my brother and I went with our father on what we thought was a vacation. It wasn't so bad. We went to Hawaii, and I remember they kept saying, we're going to go to a show tonight. Okay, great. We're going to go to a show. Fantastic. I remember standing up on those little the velvet booths in this big ballroom, and the band started to play, and the curtain opened, and everybody's applauding and screaming and all that, and I looked up, and I said, wow, that looks like Papa up there. It is Papa, and he was smiling, and they were smiling, and it was, that connection of him making those people happy in that room, really, I think that was it for me. That's what really affected me on that, and Gunner and I also have another joke that when our dad was when the teachers in our school heard that on Parent Teacher Day that Ricky Nelson was coming to the school, it was the first time and the only time all year they started putting their makeup on. So we figured something was going on.
From a musical standpoint, at what point did you really appreciate the great music he made?
Oh, from jump. I mean, that's the thing is that some people might think because our music, my brother and I, that we're famous for. was a completely different style. It was more of a melodic heavy rock kind of thing that was really popular, especially around the mid '80s to late '80s and early '90s. But the fact is, if you listen to our music, the through line is still there, which is it's all about a great song. It's all about a great melody. And Gunnar and I were really affected by our father's music since we were, as I mentioned, kids. And it was really what they call now the Laurel Canyon sound. He was really a pioneer of that whole thing that came out of the Laurel Canyon area in Hollywood, where we grew up in the Hollywood Hills. So it was Rick Nelson and the Stone Canyon Band. It was Linda Ronstadt. It was Jackson Browne, Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. I mean, you could go on. It was that whole thing that was happening. And it was our dad was really, he had come out of that whole teen idol phase of his life, the original teen idol, actually, according to Life magazine, with all of those hit records and all those. He was the first video artist. I mean, he invented the first conceptual rock music video with Traveling Man. And then he reinvented himself as a country rocker. He was actually, when he was inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, given credit for being one of the very pioneers of what became the California sound, which led to, like, our dad's bass player, Randy Meisner, was a founding member of the Eagles a few years later, that type of thing. So it was really neat because he, unlike a lot of those teen idols and guys from the 50s, really reinvented himself as an artist, and people that had kind of written him off as a pretty guy just made for TV. He was that, but he was the real deal, and they had to really kind of reckon with the fact that Ricky Nelson might be pretty, but he had a whole lot to say.
And he went from that Ricky Nelson to Rick. He kind of sort of made that transition, which sometimes is tough for teen idols or even kids who are in a TV show. So that was something that he was able to navigate somewhat successfully.
It's really true. You know, I was one of the last people in an interview. My brother and I actually talked to David Cassidy before he passed, and David had a very relatively similar situation that our dad did, but he never got a chance to really reemerge as a singer, songwriter, artist. You know, it was one of those things. What a wonderful guy he was. He was so sweet and lovely and a huge success. I mean, the same type of jet engine, girl screaming type of success that our dad had in his earlier years and stuff like that. And he said the nicest things about our father. You know, they both set attendance records at the Atlantic City Steel Pier. But, the one thing that I remembered thinking was, he had a little bit more trouble, I think, later on, just because I think there was a problem with him to a certain degree of when you're getting older, just as a man, and you spent a lot of your time when you were in your younger years being somebody's first crush. Or whatever. Gunnar and I kind of go through that. I know it's hard to think about that now. We're 54. But, a lot of people that kind of contact us or whatever or come to our show say, I had your posters on my wall, And so there is a part of them that wants you to stay, 18, 19, 20 years old for the rest of your life, let alone theirs. So our dad, I think he very gracefully and I think very adeptly navigated those waters and made a real mark that it brought him into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
So Ricky loses the Y, becomes Rick. You cut your hair. Who was the first of the two of you to actually get your hair cut?
Well, it was actually me. And the funny thing, as we're saying now, just with what's been happening the last year and a half, I let my hair grow out again just to see if it would happen. And now I'm like, I look like I did a long time ago. So our hair's a little bit, longer than shoulder length, and it's an interesting thing to kind of, again, it's almost the same thing that our dad had, which is whether it was dropping the Y from his name or, playing, oldie shows and things like that, later on when everybody wanted him to do that. You have to be very, cautious about those choices and stuff like that because clearly they matter. And it's funny that you brought up the dropping the Y from the name thing, which he did when he was 21 years old as a kind of like a marketing thing. It was, he was married now, he dropped the Y, Hello, Mary Lou, Traveling Man came out that year, and then the Beatles happened. And so he had to kind of navigate those waters and stuff. But funny, it always is cyclical because we were living with our father, very close to them right before he passed. And he actually found himself in a recording studio, which was Memphis Recording Sessions. People know it as Sun Studios. And it was, an event, even though he wasn't a Sun artist because he was making the television show, Sam Phillips invited him saying, look, if he wasn't on that TV show, he would have been right there with Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, Roy Orbison, Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash. And the fact is, Elvis, of course, wasn't there. But Carl Perkins, Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison, all those Sun guys, Jerry Lee, they were all there with our dad. And they wound up navigating into the other room, and our pop was, you know, just kind of gobsmacked with all these heroes, one of which he had never met yet. His real hero wasn't Elvis. It was Carl Perkins. And Carl Perkins and our dad are in folding chairs in the tracking room, and Carl takes a deep breath and turns his chair and faces him, and he says, "Well, Ricky, it looks like we're the last two real rockabillies left." And our dad came home from that trip, and he opened the door into the kitchen, and he said, "Carl Perkins called me Ricky. I don't care if anybody calls me Ricky now. I'm over it. Okay, if it's good enough for Carl, it's good enough for me." So by the time he passed away, people were calling him Ricky again.
Did your dad ever share the sort of garden party experience with you and what brought that song to be?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, we talk about it a lot in the show. I think the point of it is that every man has his line in the sand that he has to draw. And our dad spent a good portion of his life, how he felt he was who he thought everybody wanted him to be, you know? I mean, we're going to be really honest here and say he was really kind of a show pony. I mean, people tuned in to the family TV show just to see Ricky sing after a certain amount of time. I mean, we have letters from the network saying, "We're canceling the show if Ricky leaves to go pursue music, you know, 24/7, so he could only go out on weekends for years, you know, that type of thing. Or on hiatus, he'd go out on tour. And so our dad was asked to play one of those oldie shows, and this is 1972, I believe. And it was one of these big events at Madison Square Garden, and he really didn't want to play it because of the fact that it was billed as a, you know, return to the 50s kind of concert. And he had a Stone Canyon band. His hair was longer. He was dressing different. He was covering Bob Dylan songs and writing his own music. I mean, it was a really different thing. And the promoter talked him into it. And our dad said, "Listen, my experience with being on television my whole life, with all due respect, is that people want you to stay black and white television, you know, Ricky, for the rest of your life." And he said, "It's not who I am, and they're going to be disappointed." And he said, "If you're there, they're going to love you. So we're going to," you know, he gave him special billing. And he said that he got there just in time to see Chuck Berry duck walking across the stage and looking exactly like he did in the late 50s. And the Shirelles were on the bill, and Gary U.S. Bonds and a lot of his friends. But he got out there with his Stone Canyon band. And there's some conjecture here, and it's funny, you know, when you get close to New York, when I play shows near New York, people say, "Oh, these cops were roughing somebody up, and so the audience started booing." Well, I've heard it enough times from my dad, that's not what he saw, and it doesn't really matter what happened, but the truth was the audience turned on him, because there was this long-haired hippie freak on stage that was supposed to be their childhood crush in black and white, and this booing ensued, and our dad, you know, after about four or five songs, he had just played the Rolling Stones' "Honky Tonk Woman," which he had just covered. It was a contemporary song at the time. And that was too much for the people that wanted to return to the 50s, and they booed him off the stage. And on the way home, he, you know, of course, was completely dejected. Nobody came back to visit him. You know, a lot of his friends were there, and they didn't even know what to say, so nobody even visited him backstage. And on the way home, he thought about it. And about a week later, he woke up one night, and the entire song was done in his head. He could hear it like it was playing on a stereo. And he wrote it all the lyrics around one piece of paper, which is actually on the back of the album cover jacket, you could see. He didn't even want to get up, and including the Carl Perkins ending. Dun, 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 dun. It was all there. He knew it. And, you know, what was great about that song was it was one of the most unlikely comeback songs ever. It was released, you know, everything happens for a reason, God has a plan. You know, the head of the record company, which was MCA at the time, hated the fact that he had to write our dad a check because that was part of his deal, and the deal was almost up, and he couldn't wait to get him off of the label, and he went on vacation to Europe with his family, and by the time he got back, Rick Nelson had a top 10 record with Garden Party. There was a disc jockey in New York named Pete Fornatale that had been there that night and locked himself in his room and played it on endless loop on one of New York's biggest stations. And by the time the guy from the record company got back, he was screaming, saying, "I can't believe I got to deal with this guy again. I just, you know, he was almost off the label. You guys really screwed up." And our dad had a whole new career with it. But I think the line in the song, "You can't please everyone, so you got to please yourself." I really understand what that means, because, you know, if you fail and it's something, you do something that you believe in, you really can live with that a whole lot more than doing something that you knew wasn't right or that somebody talked you into and failing. And I've lived that personally in my entertainment career. So more power to you, Pop. You did a great job.
Absolutely. And, you know, your grandfather was such a businessman. He set up a great record deal with your father early on that really kind of, a lot of times those early rockers kind of got shafted from different record labels and people like that. But it seemed to be something that he was, you know, very, I guess, forward thinking of at the time.
Well, you know, Grandpa Ozzie was a lawyer, and people didn't know that. He had a law degree from Rutgers, which was Ivy League at the time. So the family wound up owning the show, which was something that also didn't happen. I think Lucy and Desi managed to negotiate that as well. They just, it was a pretty neat thing to do. He negotiated complete creative control over the television show. And funny enough, when our dad did his first single, which was almost kind of a fluke, it was to impress a girl, our grandfather Ozzie took it around town, around L.A., you know, which was a big music city and still is. And our dad got passed on by everybody, which is really ironic. They had the number one show in the country. It was weird. And I think there was a disdain for rock and roll music in general. But people in the music industry at the time said, well, you know, if he's playing on the television show, why would anybody go out and buy it? It's a bad business deal for us to do a deal with him. And our grandfather, who was a former band leader, thought they were completely wrong and the television show might be a wonderful way of marketing music. And so they released the first single on a little jazz label called Verve. And there was a guy named Barney Kessel, a jazz music legend, a guitar player that actually worked on the Ozzie and Harriet show doing some of the music. He had a little music store in Hollywood, and he also was an A&R guy at Verve. And so they did a singles deal. And it exploded. You know, it sold 1 million copies that week. And the funny thing was, the guys from Verve said, okay, it's time to make another single, because it was singles world, not even an album world. And our grandfather said, well, we're going to take it somewhere else now that we've got some success. Thank you for that. And he said, well, what are you talking about? We've got a contract. He said, yeah, well, we really don't, because, Rick signed it, and he was 16. And it was like, you know, the record stopped. And they negotiated a new deal with Imperial, which was a label of Fats Domino and some other, some other greats. And the rest is history.
Yeah, excellent. You should know that Craig and I are also, Craig, you saw the Ozzie Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet live when it was on
TV. Oh, yeah, sure. In fact, there would be nights, I've got to tell you, Matt, there would be weeks where I would hope I would see the Traveling Man video, because I thought it was so cool, what a great song, and just done so well. Now I watch it, I go back, and I see James Burton there, of course, who went on to play with Elvis later. But what a great performance, and what a great time that was.
It sure was. I mean, James is a friend of ours, and he's actually come out and played the show with us from time to time. And you know, what stories. You know, James used to live at the Ozzie and Harriet house. You know, the house that you saw in the exterior shots, you know, the opening shot of Ozzie and Harriet was their real home in Hollywood. And different times, you know, people would stop by, you know, and try to, you know, Harriet used to say they used to try to sneak up the lattice and get into Ricky's bedroom and wait for him. You know, it was funny. But different era. And you're right. People used to tune in and hope that those videos would come on, especially, you know, Traveling Man was fantastic because Ozzie wrote, produced, edited, and directed and starred in all 435 episodes. So one night he thought, well, you know, they joked that it was Rick's comeback at the age of 21 when he released the single Hello Mary Lou and Traveling Man on the same single. And Grandpa thought, well, I'm going to try to put some footage of travel scenes behind him when he's singing it. And he didn't know that he was inventing the first conceptual video ever. But that's what the Smithsonian gives him credit for doing. There were obviously performance videos, but nothing like that. And so it was a kind of a neat thing that he did. And I do know that those performances were definitely something that not only drove the show, but a lot of kids used to tune in just hoping that Ricky was going to play. And if he didn't, it made them want to tune in the next week. I mean, it was so Pavlovian. Our grandfather had everybody hooked. But it was a loving way of doing that. And they really, of course, integrated a whole lot more music towards the latter part of the show's run.
Show is Ricky Nelson Remembered, coming up at the Stocker Arts Center Friday, November 19th at 7:30. Matthew, along with his brother Gunner, performing there and doing their music. And I see on your current music scene that you're doing things. You actually have something coming out on vinyl. How odd is that happening in the world these days?
You know, it's made a huge comeback, believe it or not. You know, people are really rediscovering real music. And Gunner and I always say how fortunate we were to have gone through so many different eras where technology developed. I mean, we genuinely were, I think our first recordings were on 8-track analog, which was really cutting edge at the time in the 70s. And then it went to 16 and 24-track, and then linking machines together, editing things with a razor blade. I mean, no computers, nothing that you could fix in the mix. It just had to be good. And I think that I have such an immense respect for guys like our father, and you mentioned James Burton and Elvis and all those guys, because when you hear those records, the earlier records, they didn't have the technology to fix it. It was either good or it was bad. And they would take time to mic everything up, put everything around, or get the blend right. And what you heard was a performance. And the Beatles did an amazing job, and of course experimented more with overdubs and stuff later on. But right in the beginning there, it was like, did it sound good? Good. Okay, let's move on. I mean, they would record on Friday, and it would be on the air on Monday. That's how fast it was. And Gunnar and I have such an amazing gift to have been a part of that before computers came in, before cell phones, before auto-tune, all of that thing. And so when we went back and decided to, we did a big deal with our former record company, which is now Universal Music Group, just recently, I got a chance to actually, the actual master tape for our album After the Rain, which sold millions of copies, but it was lost because there were some, you know, there was a big fire that happened in Los Angeles that people were talking about, and we were on the manifest of, you know, complete losses. We thought we'd lost our master tape forever, and somebody had put it in the wrong box and shipped it to New York, and they found it. And what I'm talking about is the 2-track analog un-EQ'd tape, which you need to, quote, remaster an album. And I got finally, you know, I'm in the Capitol Tower. I've got my old reels of analog tape in front of me. I remember where I was 30 years ago, you know, when we did that at Cherokee Studios in Los Angeles and Soundworks. And I'm actually EQing my record. Now, what that does is it makes the levels, because of technology, you're hearing stuff that I heard in the studio that the general public didn't hear. And we got that actually cut. You cut onto vinyl as it's going down. You have to EQ it differently. And to sit there holding the vinyl record, we put it out in 180 gram audiophile vinyl as a special release, and I think we're going to re-release it now that we did this deal. It's pretty amazing to actually sit there and, you know, 30 years ago we were the last band. Nelson was the last band to have a vinyl record on the Geffen label. And 30 years later, we were one of the first bands to come back, re-EQ our original masters, and put it out on 180 gram audiophile vinyl. Pretty awesome. And that's what's happening in the world now. One thing I can say that is relevant is that with this show coming, it's a celebration of the launch of a collection of video. We went in, the family went in, and we restored the Ozzy and Harriet show off of the 35-millimeter films in 4K high definition. And when I'm saying the difference between what people have been seeing on those late night shows or on YouTube or whatever, and what we're putting out, it's honestly stunning to me. I cried the first time I saw it because it looked like I was watching a three-dimensional black and white version of my family. It was so unbelievable. And Time Life is now running the infomercial, and it's been really successful. And we're starting with the first 50 of our favorite episodes and rolling it into 100.
Wow. That's great. That's really great to see and hear and be able to relive some of that as well. One final question I had for you, and I was trying to, you grew up around a lot of different musicians coming through your home as well. Who was the one that taught you the most guitar or gave you the help on any kind of fingering on the fretboard?
You know, I would have to say that it was my dad, and it wasn't much. He used to joke and say he's the world's worst teacher because he was self-taught. And as a result, I'm self-taught. And I started on the bass guitar, which is still my primary instrument. Gunnar was a drummer. So we kind of grew up, you know, out in the hayloft in a barn, because it was away from the house, playing to records. That's how we started. And, you know, obviously the impetus to do it, the motivation was because I would see my father play and all that. And I mistakenly thought, oh, bass is easier. It's only got 4 strings, not 6. You know, and we took a couple of lessons, a little piano, all that. And the thing was, when I got into the world of the bass, you know, I was a big Paul McCartney fan growing up. You know, he sang and played, and I was a Beatles nut. And I would see my dad's bass player, and that's what I wanted to do. But my dad would go on the road, and he worked hard. He was, you know, 300 shows a year kind of hard. And he would come back, and he would see how we developed. And I remember the first time he tried to show me a couple of things, and I think he got a little frustrated in a sweet way, you know, in a dad way, not in a mean way. And he just said, oh, look, I'll be honest with you, pal, I'm just a horrible teacher. I don't know what I'm doing on this thing. Because he wasn't a bass player. And so he couldn't really show me much. But later on, after we had, we had a band and we were playing in clubs and doing a lot of stuff. I mean, we started playing when we were about 7. We started playing clubs when we were 12. When our dad started spending time with us, that was different. That was us with a couple of guitars sitting and picking together, which was amazing. And we never got a chance to sing with our father on stage, although we do something like that virtually in this show, not to give away the whole show, but we do sing with our dad in this show because it's about time. But we opened for him a couple of times. And I remembered seeing him off to the side of the stage with the biggest grin on his face you'd ever see. He was so proud of us. And, you know, we definitely connected not only as his sons, but he came to see, about a week before he passed away, he came to see one of our shows in Hollywood, and we sold out our first club. It was Johnny Depp's club now called the Viper Room. And he snuck in. You know, he never did that. We didn't expect him to go, but he snuck in, and, we sold the club out, a little club, so not a big deal, but a big deal when you're starting band. And I saw him on the back wall with these aviator sunglasses with that same grin, just like looking at all the people and looking at us. And he stayed the whole time. And I couldn't have been happier to see him there. And we found ourselves up at our house where we were living. And our parents got divorced years earlier, but we were back in with our dad and stuff. And, you know, it's bittersweet. You know, we saw the sun coming up over the San Fernando Valley in a house that used to belong to Errol Flynn. And sitting there talking to my dad and about everything. It's, you know, in the kitchen. It always happens, the greatest conversations. And the old Christmas tree was there from the party the week before, and he was about to go out on his last tour where we lost him. And he said, boys, I want you to know that I love you. And I said, well, we love you too, Pop. And, you know, Nelson, we do that all the time. We say that a lot, and I think it's important, most important thing. And he said, boys, I just want you to know that I consider you my peers. I respect you, and I admire you as musicians, as my peers. And that's when the tears flowed. You know, we hugged each other, whatever. And I look back all these years later, and we were supposed to be on that plane with him. But, you know, last minute, he just said, guys, I'm going to do this myself. I'll come back, and we'll spend more time when I come back. But he had a feeling. And so he went with it, and we're still here, and he's not. But, you know, I remember thinking that all those years later, what a gift we had to connect with him for those last few months when we turned 18 and moved back in with him and connected as musicians and as men and as sons. You know, most people that don't get that, you know, they don't have that kind of a reckoning. And we have a lot of gifts now because we had so much that he left behind. And I always say this, I would give anything that I have for 5 minutes with our dad. You know, it really teaches you appreciation. But definitely tell people that you love them while you got them here. And I think that's what we do with this show. It's an open love letter to a guy that we really miss, and we celebrate his life.
And people are going to come and enjoy this for sure. Friday, November 19th, 7:30 at the Stocker Arts Center, Lorain County Community College. And Ricky Nelson Remembered, starring Matthew and Gunnar Nelson. Matthew, our guest this morning. We appreciate your time and sharing the stories with us. Thank you very much.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. And listen, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, you know, God bless, take care of yourselves, and we're going to see you very soon.
Absolutely. And we should check out your Matthew Mondays, by the way. I find those highly entertaining now that I'm hooked on some of those posts.
I got to get back to it. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Be sharing my experiences as a father of a 7-year-old. It's interesting. Thanks, guys.
Thanks very much, Matthew. Yep. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.